session number 6016, Reel 3.
An old admiral where?
Of years ago, because the Navy's all tradition. Grogham, his name was, Grogham. He started that craze up because he found it was neat rum sending sailors in those days round the bend or, you know, screeching or irresponsible, let's put it that way.
Coming back to your revolver, where did you get that from?
Well, I bought it, I think. I forget now, or I might have given somebody a sort of run for it. I don't know. But it came my way. It was a seven-shot. It was for my own personal, even with a submachine gun, as it was. But it was there in case anything did go wrong. I had it in my pocket. It just fitted into my jumper, in my pocket, in my jumper. I would pull it out as a sort of cowboy used to, and used to hold seven. So it gave you a fair chance. There was lead bullets, the old-fashioned lead bullets of long tutus, not the shorter ones. So it had a fair old hitting power. By the time it hit anything, the bullet would flatten out to about the size of a modern two-pence piece.
So where had the person got it from that you bought it from?
You don't ask questions like that. I didn't, anyway.
I mean, was it a government gun?
No, it was an American one, as a matter of fact. I don't know quite where he got it from. I can't even remember the make of it, because it was a double-barrelled name. Wasn't the usual stuff that you get from the States.
And did many of the seamen have their own weapons?
Oh, yes, very often you'd find. In fact, that was only one of what I had. I had several during my career in the Navy. I started off with a 45 Italian one that somebody had got from somewhere. Again, I didn't ask where. There's much as I could do to reach my fingers. In fact, I used to have to use my middle finger to reach the trigger to pull it. They're so heavy, I think, by the time you sort of point it at somebody, at their head, you'd probably hit their feet by the time you finished. It was that heavy, especially when it was loaded.
Were you permitted by the officers?
Oh, no.
Have these
Nobody
guns?
Knew about it. In fact, I had a 2.2 rifle as well, which I kept concealed. When I was in HMS Pyramids, so I had great fun shooting rats with that.
What would have happened if the authorities had found out that you had these personal weapons?
You'd have been in what they used to call the rattle.
What was that?
That was, you'd have been in bother. You'd probably got a stoppage of money and leave. That was their punishment. If you were in the rattle, somebody would sort of report you to an officer or the officer of the watch, and he would either decide to deal with it himself, or you'd go to the first lieutenant as it would be on a ship, or if it was more serious, to the skipper himself. Now, dish out punishments such as 14, number 11, which meant 14 days leave, stoppage of leave, and 14 days stoppage of pay. And you would have to work in the dog watches, which is 4 o'clock in the afternoon, or 6 is the first dog, and 6 in the, to 8 in the evening is the second dog, is the last dog. You'd be put on stupid things like scrubbing decks and anything to say, you know, so you weren't sort of socialising with the rest of your mates.
Why are they called dog watches?
That's something I never did find out, but the first dog and last dog is 4 o'clock in the afternoon till 6 is the first, then from 6 to 8 is the last.
So, the rattle, to be in rattle means to be in trouble, does
in
it?
In the rattle, not just in rattle, in the rattle, yeah. It
means to be in trouble.
Hmm. If a petty officer threatens you, I'll put you in the rattle.
Was there any other slang that you can remember that they had in the Navy in those days?
Yeah, I probably can think of some. But that was the main one. If you were in the rattle, you were really in trouble. Lots of swear words, too, that I learned I didn't know in TV Street.
Such as?
I still, oh, you know, you call anybody a swine, you call them a bastard. Straight out, you know, you wouldn't sort of mess about, and that was recognised, and eventually became part of your sort of vocabulary. You spoke with swear words to describe things.
You mean more than people did in Civvy Street?
Oh, yes, I certainly don't use them at home, or since.
Coming back to your personal weapons...
Yes?
Did you ever use them, apart from shooting at rats?
Not in anger, no.
How did you dispose of them? How did you get rid of your own personal guns?
Well, the first one I had was over this Italian 45 revolver. I think my brother was in the home guard, because he was still home. I asked him if he would like to have it. He said, well, they didn't want him, so we did know a chap who collected them would be interested. So I think I sold it to him for a couple of quid, which was more than I paid for it. Next one I acquired was a Lee Enfield, a British 38, from a chap who'd been out in Egypt and somehow acquired it. Now, they got one or two rounds for that, though, one or two rounds of ammunition, and 38 stuff was not easy to come by, as 2-2 was. But I eventually sold that for a couple of quid. I made a bit of profit on it anyway. And the next thing I acquired was a 2-2 rifle from somebody. And that was only designed to take short 2-2 bullets, and the Navy ammunition was long 2-2, so when I went to Scapa, there was a friendly engineering shop there. I gave this bloke a slip of my top two, bought it out a bit more for me, the breech, so it would accommodate the long 2-2 bullets. And I eventually sold that. But that wasn't the last weapon I had. Another one I got, after I got rid of this 2-2 revolver, I acquired a .225 Webley Scott automatic, which was a civilian gun. I had one box of ammunition for that, that was all. I bought that from an officer. I don't know what he wanted it for, because I'd say it was only a small pistol. It probably knocked somebody flat, but wouldn't be any good for distance. In fact, I did read later on in the war, about 1943 or 4, that Admiral Darlon, the French admiral, was shot in North Africa, and they used a .225 automatic pistol, and it killed him. Mind you, he had three shots, killed him.
How long were you on HMS Pyramus?
I was there probably until just after D-Day, when they realised that the Germans wouldn't be making an attempt to to come and invade us in that direction.
Did you get promotion whilst you were there?
No, this was probably afterwards. I came back to depot.
Didn't you? When did you become leading lineman?
When I went back to a depot, I decided to put in. You sort of put in. You didn't put in for anything. You always slapped in for anything. Not a bit of slang.
What does that mean?
Well, you sort of put in. In fact, if you, that's like a moan about. You used to slap in to see some bastards.
What does that
Which
mean?
Which meant you used to put in a request to see somebody of importance. That's the other bit of slang that I was thinking of. You always used to step in to see someone, or some bastard, as they used to call it. And you put in a request to become, to go on a course, for you put in a divisional officer in Portsmouth, somebody showed me where to go, somebody who had already done this and become a leading wireman. He said, you want to try it because of the extra money you get and the fact that you get excused washing up after mealtime. Another menial task.
So did it make much difference to your pay to become leading one?
Oh, yes.
How much?
Probably about 50 pence, which doesn't sound much now, but quite a bit in those days.
50 pence a week or a day?
A week. You just get paid once a fortnight if you were lucky. Because if you were at sea, you didn't want money anyway, there's nothing to buy. Well, they did keep a well-stocked canteen, as small as it was. You used to have sacks of stuff in it. Plus, I should tell you a bit more about that. It might be of interest. That on journeys, when we were at sea, after a couple of days, they'd run out of fresh food, rely entirely upon tinned stuff like corned beef. I remember one meal we had was corned beef and boiled rice. So we used to try and stock up with as many biscuits and things as we could, keep them in our locker, and bars of chocolate. So if you were, as it was sometimes, if you were down after, as we were, on our action station, if the sea was that rough, it was coming over midships. You were stuck there, they would cut communication between fore and aft. You might be stuck there all day, or even a couple of days, if the sea was that bad. Because where the torpedo tubes were, there was no lee side, it was all sort of weather side, because the weather would come at you either side, because the ship would never steer a straight course, say, from point A to point B. It was zigzag, because if a U-boat was watching you, it would simply slam a torpedo at you, and it wouldn't wait for it to hit you. You would hit it. So you zigzagged all the time. Sometimes the weather side would be the port side, and sometimes it would be the starboard side. If a chap come down the mess deck from up top, he'd say, which side's the weather side, mate? He'd say, port side. So he'd run on the starboard side to get to your post down aft. And the weather was that bad sometimes, to rig a lifeline line up. And a thick wire, about half inch or inch steel wire, connected to one end of the ship to the other, to clear you for the torpedoes, and have a lump of rope hanging from it, which you run along with. And when you got to the other end, you fling it back to your mate behind, or your oppo, as you were called, rather than mate, oppo being short for opposite number. And sometimes it would run along there with it and leave it there. So you come out of the your mess deck, pit stall, couldn't see a thing, groping for this rope, and which wasn't there. So you had to sort of make your way along as best you could by holding on to something and keeping as far away from the guardrail as you could, and hoping that another wave wasn't going to come over. Because very little freeboard on a destroyer.
What do you mean by freeboard?
Freeboard is the amount of it's out of the water. In fact, where the torpedo tubes are, they've got to be kept clear naturally. Otherwise, when they're swung round to fire, they wouldn't just wouldn't be room for them. So it's pretty flat there. And the amount of freeboard there is a matter of inches rather than feet from the deck itself to the water. It's only a matter of inches, really. So if you were zigzagging at the time, and the sea was coming at you from that direction, it simply comes straight over.
You said that the oppo was your opposite number, or your mate.
Yeah.
Did everybody have an oppo?
Or a winger.
What's a winger?
Just the same.
Everybody had an oppo then?
Yeah, opposite number, yes. Well, so if you were on, usually you travelled in three watches, red, white and blue watch, if you were lucky. That meant you'd done 4 hours work, or 4 hours on watch, and 8 hours rest. Which might sound a lot, but you'd be surprised once you get in your hammock how quickly 8 hours goes. Well, if you were on two watches, which was only red and white, or red and blue, you do 4 hours on and 4 hours off. If you're only on one watch, if it was really busy, you're stuck on watch and you kept on watch. And I don't know whether they did actually give us anything to keep us awake, but we used to manage to keep awake. A good deal younger then, of course, so it didn't matter too much.
Did were the oppos allocated? Or did
somebody you got along with was your oppo. He might be your oppo for going ashore.
But did the authorities tell you to choose an oppo?
No, it just comes natural. If you got along with somebody, you know, you'd be oppos with him. And if he was in trouble or wanted something or other he hadn't got and you had, you would sort of give it to him. He would do the same for you.
Who was your oppo?
A chap named John Grimes. Came from Liverpool. Most unlikeliest pair on earth because he's as tough as they come. He always boasted that he was Liverpool Irish, and that speaks for itself. They sort of had to fight for their lives up there where they lived.
And how did you come to be his offer?
Well, we just sort of powered up. He was a seaman torpedoman. He wasn't a wireman, but they used to work closely with us. STs they used to call them, seaman torpedoman. He used to wear a similar badge to mine. My badge was a star with a torpedo and an L underneath. The L standing for electrician in the Navy terms. But his badge was simply a star and a torpedo.
And he was your oppo when? The whole time?
On impulsive, yes, all the time.
And then you had to choose a new oppo when you left impulsive, did you?
Yes. Well, you usually power up with somebody. You don't sort of choose. It just sort of comes natural. You sort of become pals. You might get chatting to someone and find you've got a lot in common. And you say, are you going ashore tonight? You say, oh, yeah. Well, I'll come with you if you like. You go ashore and have a drink. We'll go to the picture or whatever.
Well,
become pals.
Whilst you were on Orkney, was it boring there?
Oh, yes, although there was always things to do.
Such as?
There was a cinema in the main town. There was also a naval cinema. I was actually able to go and see somebody really notable. at the time, they sent somebody over from the mainland to come and see us. Probably somebody you've never heard of, although Flanagan and Allen did come. There's also a lady who impressed me more, who you've never heard of, because she was notable in pre-war days, called Evelyn Lay.
Yes, I have heard of her, yeah.
Have you? Well, that surprises me. Yeah, she came that time.
Was this through ENSA?
I don't really know who provided it. It probably would be ENSA, I should think. But they did send people out from time to time. And there was a saying during the war on all public transport, is your journey really necessary? You know, must you travel? And when I was in India, towards the end of the war, they sent out a group of really third-rate people, and one Matlow got up, you know, probably had a few drinks, and called out, was your journey really necessary to these people? Because they were absolute, you know, they're under false pretenses, really. I think anybody could have got up and done as well as they did, with singing and cracking jokes that were stale, everybody had heard. Really third-rate they were. But I must say, I was impressed with these people they sent over to at Kirkwall there. They were first class.
Did the sailors mix with the civilian population much on Orkney?
Oh, yes. We got on very well with them. They'd always greet us with fine day. If they needed anything that we could get from the stores by devious means, then we'd always get it for them. There's one chap there, for instance, that I got very friendly with, a chap named George Sinclair, proper Orcadian. They were very slow thinking and slow speaking too. We were sort of wide boys for them, I met him, coming from the great south. Very slow, but very kind and friendly people. He wanted another lamp put up in the east room. He asked me if I would do it. I said, certainly. I said, but you know, I should get the gear, George, don't you? So if you're prepared to risk that, that's okay with me. He said, right, okay. I don't think he really understood quite what I meant. I was not going to see it. I was going to sort of offer somebody my tot to get it for me from the stores. And he would pay me for doing the job. So I did all this for him, and he paid me for it afterwards, with a couple of quid, which came in very useful, especially on leave. I mean, a couple of quid might sound nothing now, but it meant a good deal in those days.
Did the sailors go out with the girls on Orkney?
Quite a few of them did, although I didn't.
Did that cause any trouble amongst the local
people? No, not that I know of. You see some chaps, because we billeted huts up there. And our hut, where we were, was in what used to be the car park. And then about two steps, and there was a sea wall. There was Kirkwall Bay then. And the sea frequently, when it's blowing that way, would come up, hit the wall and go over the top of the hut. And down the other side, making everything wet and damp. You had to sort of make sure everything was put away in the hut. Used to come up there at quite a rate.
During your period on Orkney, did you get leave to go home?
Oh, yes, frequently.
Could you afford to go?
Well, you get a warrant. You were issued with warrants. So what you used to do, if you were stationed locally, which was at Portland as I was, and the fare home was 15 bob or 25 pence a day, I could afford that. So to keep my warrants, you were allowed so many per year. If I was stationed somewhere like Orkney. So the routine there was to get a warrant from the officer in charge, and there was a place nearby called Grimsetter, one of the parts of Orkney, where a flight used to go from there to Inverness, civilian. And if you took that, you could say you sort of about 24 hours travel.
But what did you actually have to pay out of your own pocket to get home?
Well, it would cost about £4, I should think, which was a fortune in those days, probably a month's pay. Not in my case, but in most of Matlow's pay, because, as I say, I was quite well off, really, being a wireman. And when I was a leading wireman, I was extremely well off, compared. They were only talking about shillings. Shillings did used to buy a lot in those days.
Did you come across the Americans very much?
No, I did at Reykjavik.
What impression did you get of them?
Well, rather brash, you know, sort of boastful, always smoking cigars. Always seemed to be well off, better off than we were anyway. I was giving out packets of cigarettes sort of boastfully, really.
How did the British get on with the Americans?
Not too bad, I don't think, but not as well as they could have done, I think, because Americans are very brash, and they're away from home, come over here to help us win the war, you know, win the war for us. I think that was their attitude. I didn't know very many of them.
Was there ever any trouble between the British and the Americans?
I think they used to have a punch-up now and then, yeah, although I didn't see much of it myself.
Did you ever hear of any instances?
Not really, no. But you see chaps come back on board times with their face well knocked about. Oh, I'll run into a couple of Yanks ashore, you know, they want to do this, want to do that.
What type of things would they want to do?
Either take his girl from him or sort of buy his girl a drink. And having plenty of money and being well off would naturally have put a better impression on the girl than he could have done. Or it might have been at a dance hall or somewhere where they sort of busted in on them.
So you said that you were on HMS Pyramus until after D-Day. This is 1944.
Yeah.
Where did you go to then?
Back to depot, as usual. That's when I stepped in to see someone about going on this course for a leading wireman.
So you made a request to do that, did you?
Yes. We were then sent to HMS Vernon 2, Vernon 1 being in Pompey Dockyard. They said sort of various little places outside Vernon 2, Vernon 3 or whatever. Because Victory did the same. Victory had HMS Victory 2. That was sort of spread out somewhere. But Vernon 2 was actually St Dunstan's, where the blind people were. And they were evacuated for the war. Did part of the course at the high power side of it there, which was over a month or so. And the low power part we did in HMS, Rodine. That was HMS Vernon as well. Rodine College, you might have heard of, a college for young ladies, or very fine young ladies. Probably before the war, cost them about 500 quid a year to put them there. So obviously it wasn't for the likes of ordinary people. In fact, the Queen Mother did part of her education there. And we had quite a good time there. It's away from the war, anyway. And on the coast of Brighton, it's quite nice, at Rottingdean. Especially when we were there, the time of the year.
Why was it so good for you?
Well, we were away from the war. There was no war there. You wouldn't see any planes come over Brighton, but there's nothing there to bomb.
So how did you spend your leisure time there?
Mainly in Brighton itself. I used to go to a pub called Chatfield, which was opposite the SS Bar, which was a skating rink. And Chatfield used to have a three-piece orchestra there, violin, piano and drums. And if you used to come around with a box every quite frequently during the performance, and I used to put a shilling in, and they always used to play my request, the ones I liked.
How long did your course last?
Probably about 3 months. I know that on one of the days, this might interest you too, on one of the parts of it, to learn the gyro compass, we had to go to Eastbourne, which was HMS Marlborough. But in actual fact, it was a school, an ordinary school. And I just have to use the language that he used, the chief in charge. He said, you know, doing this compass on one of the days, he was only there for a couple of days, that's all it lasted. Even then, somebody managed to fail. He said, if there's something you're not sure about, when he brought the papers and the exam papers around, he said, don't ask your mate, he won't bloody well know. He said, ask me, I'm the only bloke who knows all the answers. So I think what they want to do, make sure they've got so many passes as possible. So many people failed, and they'd probably turn them out and possibly send them back to sea again. But as long as they got a good percentage of passes, they were okay. But anyway, even then somebody managed to fail, even by asking questions. But the course itself was pretty simple. It was only part of the leading hands course to learn the gyro. There was a gyro compass and a Sperry compass, two different things entirely. One was British, one was American.
Which was which?
I think the Sperry was English, or British rather, and gyro was probably American. I'm not too sure. They both worked on the same sort of principle.
Why should an electrician, a wireman, be concerned with a compass?
Well, it's just part of the course. I don't know. I never did do anything with it afterwards. In case there was a breakdown, I suppose, at any time, at least I have somebody to call upon to repair it if necessary. But I never did have cause to use it.
So there's an electrical side to these compasses?
Hmm. Because I say, from there, back to depot, once we finished the course, and I'd passed, so I was able to put an anchor up on my arm, which indicated the fact that I was a leading hand, and everything you were paid for, you had to wear. Also, wear a good conduct badge, which is a stripe, more like a Lance Corporal in the Army. It's called a badge, not a stripe. That again brought in extra pay, just a few pence a day, but it was money. So I was a one by then, I was one badge leading wireman. The wireman's badge was on my right arm. That's your non-substantive rate, they called. But your leading hand was on your left arm with the stripe, with the badge, rather. They brought out a lot of other stupid things that I thought was unnecessary, such as the years you did in the Navy. They gave you a little badge to wear on your left arm with sort of chevrons, tiny little chevrons. Nobody ever wore them. You weren't paid for them, so why wear them?
So after your course, what happened to you then?
Back to depot and then to HMS Amzari. That's spelled AMZARI, Amzari, which was at Vizagapatam in Madras, in India, not a shore base. The intention then, I think, was to make a... We were on working on landing craft, the electrical side of it. We didn't run them. We weren't intending to sort of use them or to go ashore in them. We were maintaining them only. I think the object was that the Bay of Bengal was not all that wide. The Japs were on the Burma side. We were on the Madras side. We were on the western side of the Bay of Bengal, and the Japs were on in Burma, which is on the eastern side of it. I think the idea was that the Japs get so far, or they had got so far down Burma, to make a crossing in these landing crafts and get behind them, between them and their supplies. I think that's the object of it. But anyway, it didn't come to anything, because soon after that, it was sort of VJ Day, when the Yanks dropped that atomic bomb on Hiroshima. They quickly turned it in then.
Before we go on to this in detail, can you tell me how you got from Portsmouth to Vizagapatnam?
Yeah, Vizagapatnam. I went to Bombay first, which is normal. Then you travel across India by train, wog train, we used to call them. There's more like old cattle trucks. They're hard as iron. You used to put the shutters up at night to stop the, what we used to call the loose wallers from getting in and pinching all your gear.
What were loose wallers?
The way I interpret it was those people that have no sort of repute at all would come in and rob you of your four teeth to get them out. Yeah, loose wallers, they used to call them.
But how did you get from Portsmouth to Bombay?
By a troop ship. It's another bit of a tongue teaser, this one, tongue twister. It's a Dutch ship. Johan van Oldenbarnevelt. Do you think you make a note of that? I'm bloody if I can, not offhand.
Johan what?
Van Oldenbarnevelt.
Van?
Oldenbarnevelt.
And this was a Dutch troop carrier, was it?
Yes, they turned it as a Dutch pleasure boat probably before the war. It was certainly well equipped, lovely ship compared to what I'd been on.
What route did you take?
Straight through, from Liverpool down to... Jib, into the Med, through the Med, through the Suez, Red Sea, Indian Ocean, straight to Bombay.
Was it an uneventful voyage or not?
Well, it was, because by that time, most of the war in Europe was sort of coming to an end, or at least they were sort of well on the receiving end, the enemy. And all we had to do was keep watch on the what would have been the sun deck, I imagine, in peacetime. They'd built some concrete gun emplacements, and we was there. I made a complete fool of myself there, because I was in a short-sleeved shirt, and I had my arm resting on the gun, the concrete, and the sun was beating down on it. And from my wrist to my elbow was almost one big blister.